May it please the court. This case is about whether a false advertising action concerning a high consumer involvement purchase of a stem cell treatment can be properly certified as a class action when the alleged misrepresentation is found to be vague and subject to different interpretations, and there is no record of a uniform controlling definition or understanding as to what the misrepresentation is. The court here should reverse the order certifying the case and remand because the district court abused its discretion when it, quote, narrowly certified this case for class treatment.
What's vague about 100% patient satisfaction? Seems pretty definitive to me.
Well, the court found that it was indeed vague, and the court specifically did not adopt the plaintiff's proffered interpretation of it, which was that it was satisfaction with the outcome of treatment, the results of the treatment, and that's not what the satisfaction survey.
I thought for these purposes, efficacy was off the table. Am I confused?
No, you are correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
The court has specifically ruled that it will not try the efficacy of stem cell treatment in this case, that it is only a case about false advertising and nothing more.
Right.
And so the record here does not reflect.
I thought the record showed that there were numerous instances when, and please correct me if I'm wrong, when individuals who responded to the survey indicated dissatisfaction with their experience with StemGenics.
The survey that was proffered by the plaintiffs was the survey of Dr. Kamens, and the survey had many problems with it, including that it did not put the one graph among several graphs in the context of what was actually displayed on the website. It did not.
But a different question is being asked. A different question is being asked by Judge Parker. Didn't it always indicate that there was 100% patient satisfaction? I understand your point is satisfaction about what is an issue, but didn't it always say 100% patient satisfaction at a time when patients had complained?
It stated that there was 100% satisfaction, and that's correct, that either the patients had their expectations met or exceeded. But it never represented that was as to the outcome of the treatment.
We know that. But why isn't it misleading to say 100% patient satisfaction?
Because, number one, that was true. It was based on the exit surveys that were conducted, and that is what the each and every patient reported to StemGenics, and that's in the record. And number two, it does not comport with the plaintiff's theory of the case. And many people come to StemGenics with many different expectations of what they may accomplish at StemGenics.
And so if we disagree with you on the first point, which is the misrepresentation ruling, what's your next strongest argument?
That even if there is a common controlling definition, then we still have a problem in that Dr. Kamen's report was expressly rejected by the lower court for the purposes of showing causation and materiality here. And that the plaintiff's theory of the case is that the purchase of the stem cell treatment was made directly, it was caused by this single graph, does not comport with their damages theory, because the report of Dr. Kamens was expressly rejected for the purposes of showing causation. So you cannot impute causation and reliance across the class. There is no cohesion among this class as to what caused their purchase. Now. Numerous courts consider.
I don't follow. You have to help me understand that. I don't understand your argument along those lines. You know, I'm a potential purchaser of this service. My wife has Parkinson's. I go on your website. I see two things that are important, among many things that are important. One is that you're not making any guarantees about the efficacy of this product, but at the same time, you're telling me that there's 100% patient satisfaction. But we know now that you had, putting aside the responses to the four questions that you asked were making this survey, you'd received numerous complaints during the relevant period about the product. Why is it the 100% not misleading?
Because the 100%, look, it is true. People did respond that they didn't have positive outcomes. That's true. But that is not what the patient charts. And if you read them, they talk about, and the paragraphs introducing them, and if you put them in context, what is talked about in the charts and in the surveys is customer service and level of care and whether or not people are satisfied with the medical team or whether their expectations were met with the medical team, whether Stemgenix is a trusted partner, whether the car service and the hotel service met their was to their liking. It asks about your general experience with Stemgenix. It does not specifically ask about outcome, results, success, or
anything. Sure, it does. Certainly, that's not true. Certainly, it does. It says, "How would you describe your overall experience?" Your overall experience would bear on whether your spouse got better from his or her disease or didn't. That's part of the overall experience.
That is not what the chart communicated, and the record is replete with testimony from actual members of the class that is not how they understood those charts. And in this context, where the people are advised to meet with their physicians, to read the other disclaimers on the site that say we do not guarantee results, that is not a common controlling understanding of the charts that can be imputed across the class and for the purposes of showing some sort of cohesion with the class. I see that I am past my time. I would like to turn it over to my colleague, Christina, to discuss the problems with the damages model.
May it please the court, Christina Lucio on behalf of the appellants. The district court erred by certifying the class despite rejecting the damages model and warning that plaintiffs might find trouble in their damages analysis. Remarkably, nowhere in the district court's order does it find that plaintiff's expert, Dr. Stewart's damages model, will allow for the measurement of damages on a class-wide basis. Rather, it calls the model only a relevant concept, but Rule 23b3 requires much more in order to certify a class. Plaintiffs have to show that the damages are capable of measurement on a class-wide basis. Otherwise, the predominance element simply is not met. Here, Dr. Stewart has put forth a restitutionary model, or what he called a discount ratio model, tied to Dr. Kamen's report. A restitutionary model necessarily requires...
Help me understand why you do not believe that these PSRs were material.
Your Honor, they were not material to the purchasing decision. There's no evidence in the record which will take the materiality for consideration and make that leap to the purchasing decision. Dr. Kamen's report was the only evidence that was put forth. I would submit that the declarations, I believe we had 54 declarations and plaintiffs had somewhere around that number in terms of declarations that actually say that they viewed those patient satisfaction ratings in different ways. So not to say that everyone interpreted the patient satisfaction ratings in the same way simply is not borne out by the evidence that's been submitted. So in terms of the damages model, there are a number of problems. And to get back to Your Honor's point,
Do you dispute that 100% of the patients were not satisfied?
Your Honor, I think we're talking about two different things. And I think what we have to look at what the
patients... Okay, well, just deal with the thing that's in my question.
Well, the patient satisfaction ratings, though, Your Honor, what they say is that 100% of individuals indicated that their expectations had been met by Stemgenix's care. And I think if you read the patient satisfaction ratings in their entirety, it makes that issue clear. I think at least to a certain population, and as I indicated, at least 54 of our declarants, people who have had this procedure, said they didn't interpret them in that way. And so while there might have been a small number of complaints afterwards, I think the number is somewhere around 10% at max, I think that is not indicative of any sort of uniform understanding. And I think part of the problem also with the certification order is that the court, the damages model that was proffered by Dr. Stewart only gets to consideration as well, just as Dr. Kamen's report does. So we still have nothing that links the conduct of the defendants to to any sort of purchase. And so if you read...
Counsel, can I jump in and just ask, I guess I'm confused about that part of your argument. I thought the plaintiff's point was not that had the consumers been exposed to the truth here, they would have foregone the treatment altogether, but rather they simply would have paid less for it. And that's what they're trying to capture in the damages model. And so why doesn't Dr. Stewart, who was the damages expert, am I getting the name right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Why doesn't his methodology, or her methodology, sorry, I'm not remembering if it's a man or a woman. Why doesn't the methodology that Dr. Stewart used work here? Because as I understand it, there's a survey question that's put. Basically, you know, here's the representation that you would have been exposed to. But what if you knew this other
fact? I'm in court.
You know, how would that have affected your willingness to pay the full sticker price? And the responses are what they are. Why isn't that a valid method of measuring damages on a classified basis?
Your Honor, because it's still tethered to this idea of major improvement or significant benefit. And I think both Dr. Stewart's model and that which was created by the court that was reworked, I think both of those have that same deficiency. So without knowing what the major improvement, whatever that percentage of individuals who reported major improvement, I mean, first of all, we'll take issue with the fact that the patient satisfaction ratings in the first instance were not intended to communicate major improvement. But even if we take that somehow that's what we should be measuring here, there's no way to come up with that variable. That's not something that Stemgenix actually measured. It's not something that was reported. It's not something that we have any factual basis for putting that in. So that variable, there's no way to try it. I mean, what we're left with is trying the efficacy of the procedure, which is, again, not what we're doing in this case. So I think that's the problem with the model that's still tethered to this idea of improvement benefit, which divorces it from what the actual patient satisfaction ratings say. And more importantly, it just doesn't get us, there's no way to measure it.
Help me understand. I think I'm maybe not clear then on the facts. I thought that the statement that what people were being exposed to was basically that, hey, you know, 100% of the patients who got this treatment, they were satisfied with their overall experience, or the overall experience met their expectations. That, at least on the plaintiff's theory, creates in the minds of a reasonable consumer that what they were satisfied with was the, you know, the results. I know you dispute that, but that's at least their theory. I thought that the survey question that Dr. Stewart would put then was, well, what if you knew that in fact 50% or whatever the percentage of the people actually ended up being unhappy with the, right, that's the true fact that would be necessary to render the statement in your survey is not misleading. And I thought that was calibrated to, and then people would say, well, geez, if I knew that, I wouldn't be willing to pay $14,900. I'd pay something less.
Right, Your Honor, and that's part of the problem, is putting that second figure in, whatever that second figure is, we can't do that. There is no way to quantify that variable. One, because the term major improvement is subjective, and so someone who decided to come get stem cell therapy for a cosmetic procedure would have a different idea of improvement versus someone who had an idea of improvement on a knee pain or something like that, right? So
that's the whole problem I have. That's not why you're selling this product. You're selling this product to people who are desperately ill and for whom all other FDA-approved treatments have failed. And that's the context in which I have difficulty with your 100% patient satisfaction. I'm still, please help me get over this hurdle. I'm still not good. That's just not flat-out misleading.
Your Honor, but I think whether... Okay, so I mean, we can agree.
Nobody gets stem cells for an arthritic knee or a botched nose job.
Your Honor, I would say that the evidence actually is to the contrary. We have people who have received stem cell therapy for a wide variety of conditions. But I think in terms of the damages model, and to get to the question and the fatal deficiency here, because I'm not saying that there could not be litigation and that that issue could not be resolved in the context of an individual case. What I'm saying is it's not appropriate for class-wide treatment because we cannot determine how to quantify major improvement, significant benefit, or any of those things because they actually were not measured. So we do not know what that variable looks like. Therefore, the damages model fails in and of itself. It also fails because it doesn't isolate the premium that was paid because of this 100% satisfaction claim. So putting aside the representations, putting aside those ideas, plaintiffs haven't put forth a viable damages model. And so we can't do this. We can't try this on a class-wide basis. The efficiencies that come with a class action typically
are not here.
Counsel, you're also over time, so I'm going to cut you off there, please.
Your Honor.
And we'll hear from opposing counsel.
Yes, thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Joanna Scavone on behalf of the appellees, the class, and their representatives. So as the district court recognized in its class certification order, this is a marketing case and not a medical one. The claims for relief arise out of exactly what the court was talking about, questioning opposing counsel about, the targeted advertising campaign against this small and vulnerable group of consumers. And each of the claims for relief center around the allegations that StemGenix made false or materially misleading claims of 100% patient satisfaction, and that those representations were likely to deceive a reasonable consumer. The critical inquiry at the class certification stage, as I think each of you have delved into, is whether there are common questions that can be resolved on those points. And the district court here found there are. With respect to that, the first question being a binary, is it false or misleading or not? And much of the argument that the opposing counsel has presented goes to the truth, their defense of the truth of that. That is a merits question. The inquiry at this stage is whether or not it can be resolved on a class-wide basis. The second common issue being materiality. We offered expert survey evidence. The other side did not present any opposing expert survey. And our expert, Dr. Kamens, concluded that these statements were material. Now, even though that goes to not the ultimate decision to purchase, that it goes to the consideration, it is still relevant. It is still an issue that can be determined on a class-wide basis. That is what the district court found, that materiality can be determined on a class-wide basis, and that enough evidence was presented of that in support of that at the certification stage to give rise to the presumption of reliance. And that is where we get then to the next common question, this legal inquiry under the objective standard. Is the materially misleading statement or the false statement likely to deceive a reasonable consumer? And that's an objective inquiry. And so those are the common questions that the district court identified. And then really, it sounds as if the court agrees with the district court, giving deference to the district court as it should. And then the question becomes the district court's weighing of that with respect to the predominance inquiry. And so, again, the district court's weighing of that was proper. Those questions, and we don't have to have every issue as a common issue, but they must predominate. And the court laid out Those inquiries, that binary inquiry, and then the objective inquiry about likelihood to deceive, and said that those issues predominate in the case. And so this is...
Could I get a word, Edgewise, and ask you to back up? Because I'm giving you, for purposes of discussion, the misrepresentation issue. I think Judge Parker's right, that the court's concern here is animated by a very vulnerable patient population that's looking for hope, and that in that context, in the context of everything we're talking about here, that a jury could decide that this was the surveys were misleading. What about these classes? What about these subclasses? You're talking about materiality, and we're talking about whether it's important to the purchasing decision as opposed to just considering whether to make this, you know, pretty significant step. But it seems to me that we need to know whether or not people saw the patient satisfaction surveys. We don't have that, do we?
Well, the class is actually very carefully drawn. Both of the subclasses are very carefully drawn. California law does not require that every person have seen it. What it requires is that there have been broad and pervasive exposure to the target population. And so I don't think there's any dispute in this case that Stemgenics did target a population with its email marketing campaign and its other outreach efforts. And so the class actually is very tailored to that. It requires that a consumer either visited the homepage and the satisfaction ratings were present on the homepage by design of Reader. So either that they visited the homepage or the website of Stemgenics, and or that they received an email with the satisfaction rating.
Subclass A talks about people who purchased stem cell treatment from Stemgenics, right, after visiting the website, when the website contained the patient satisfactory surveys, or when they got the email. That's subclass A.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right. So have you discussed subclass B? Are you going to discuss subclass B?
It's the timing distinction in the April 2016 arena when a disclaimer was added to those satisfaction ratings. And so that inquiry, I think the reason...
That's the disclaimer, that's the disclaimer that explains the sort of the context that these people have, they're just on their way out the door, basically. They're just checking out that disclaimer.
Yes, Your Honor. And so what the district court did here was draw that line of demarcation in time, and the court still determined that even in subclass B, there are common issues. So it is the same representation of 100% patient satisfaction. And even with the disclaimer, it still could be materially misleading to consumers. So that is still appropriate for a class-wide resolution. Now, certainly when a finder of fact considers this case, it's possible that defendants would be successful in defending that. But in light of the disclaimer...
Could they be successful? Forgive me for interrupting, but you're kind of at a high-level generality, and this issue is important to me. Could they be successful by showing that the plaintiffs don't remember seeing the patient satisfaction surveys, or they didn't see them, or they weren't influenced by them?
Your Honor, that would go on the merits potentially to defeating a presumption of reliance. But the question about truth or falsity is a binary. And so that question, even in light of, it will still be determined on a, it could still be determined on a class-wide basis with respect to subclass B. The consideration for the finder of fact would be that the representation that they viewed the satisfaction ratings either on the homepage or in an email, or that they were exposed to it, forgive me, not viewed, but exposed to it, which is what California law requires. And that additional context could be there of the disclaimer, but it still could be misleading. And so that still could be answered
right.
In the affirmative.
If they saw it. And I'm having a hard time with predominance in this particular type of case, because they're not buying a product like in the Briseno case. You know, it's a bottle of salad oil on the shelf that says all natural. This is a different type of product, and the purchasing decision is very different. And we have people with different... a class with different underlying medical conditions, some of them, I think, very, very serious, and maybe some not so much, per opposing counsel, and people for whom that price tag would be maybe a very great deterrent or maybe not a deterrent at all. And then there's this other element that And I don't know how you answer this question on a class-wide basis, because these people were all required to consult with their physicians and get independent advice about whether this treatment was going to be right for them. So how do those questions get answered on a class-wide basis?
Well, Your Honor, as the district court found here, again, it is a marketing case and not a medical case. It's not about the efficacy or those individual choices.
And I appreciate that.
And so, I think the answer to your question is that those inquiries don't come into the resolution of the truth or falsity or whether the representation was materially misleading. And then the second inquiry about likely.
Why not?
Because again, it is about the truth or falsity of the statement on a class-wide basis. And so, because this isn't, Your Honor,
still have to show reliance. You still have to, right? It's still a consumer case. I appreciate that it's a marketing case, but you still have to show reliance.
And it is a product. It was sold as a product. So I think actually it is beneficial to think of this, even though it is a higher price tag and even though it is in the context of medical treatment, it is a product. It was sold like a product. It was marketed like a product to drive a product. And this was a very intentional marketing scheme. And so where reliance comes in, Your Honor, is that class-wide basis, because we presented and the other side did not present. We have two things I think that are relevant to your question. One is the survey, which presents, as the district court found, materiality on a class-wide basis that gets to a presumption of reliance. The second important piece of information, and this is where I disagree with opposing counsel, is our class representatives also, so under the Tobacco II cases, it's the class representatives that present actual reliance. And our class representatives in this case did do that. We have declarations from both Ms. Gardner and Ms. Brewer that they saw the satisfaction ratings 100%. It was a very important consideration to them that they either wouldn't have purchased or they would not have paid as much for the treatment. And so that is the inquiry that is relevant for the class certification stage. And it, so predominance is not defeated as a result of that, either with respect to subclass A or even.
I'm not sure. Can we back up on that? Forgive me for interrupting, but you know these issues often overlap, usually overlap, and they can be devilish to try to tease apart. But they have another argument about the typicality of those two representatives. So when you say it was important to them, those two particular human beings had, you know, very different information that didn't strike me as particularly. And I appreciate typicality is not a tough standard to meet, but they did have other information that seemed likely atypical.
So, Your Honor, on that point, typicality, I think this circuit's case law indicates and supports the conclusion that plaintiffs can come to the table with a different story and different information, but in a consumer class action, that does not make them atypical. There was a recent decision by this court, Ramirez. So that's the case in which he was placed on a credit watch list, and there was this he had more damages because of his attempts to remedy that, hiring an attorney, missing vacation, et cetera, et cetera. But he was not atypical because it was the injury that was the same. And so he was still typical of the class. And here, the class representatives, even if one was a nurse and one had access to information about Stemgenix, it doesn't make them atypical. They were still subject to the misrepresentation. That is the key inquiry here that is common to the class, and they were injured in the same way because it influenced a decision, and with those two class representatives, their evidence actually established this actual reliance in this case.
Or at least they may have been injured in the same way, and that the answer to that question is capable of class-wide resolution. I think that has to be your position.
Yes, and the case law merely requires that their claims are coextensive and it doesn't have to be identical for the typicality test. As you point out, it is a permissive test. It's one of the criteria that's permissive. And the district court got it right when it found that the class representative's claims are typical. They satisfy that coextensive test here.
Can I take you back to the question that Judge Kristen asked a little bit ago about whether the people in the class actually saw the patient satisfaction surveys. I the district court's order as conceiving of the class as consisting of people who actually saw the survey results, and that makes sense because none of your potential customers could possibly have been injured in any way if they didn't actually see the misrepresentation. But as Judge Kristen pointed out, the way the class is defined in the certification order, all the person had to do was basically land on the website, presumably the homepage. And we do have a screenshot, at least at one point in time, of what that looked like. And the survey results are there on the homepage, but you have to scroll down. There's a bunch of other information that's presented. And so I guess I don't see why we just can assume that everybody who landed on the homepage necessarily saw and therefore potentially were misled by the misrepresentation you're attacking.
So, Your Honor, the testimony of Rita Alexander is that the satisfaction ratings, that 100% satisfaction rating and the pie charts were intentionally placed in a very prominent place on the homepage. And so I think what the district court was driving at here was when you have a targeted campaign, for example, in the Tobacco 2 cases and others, and it's a pervasive campaign, the law does not require that every member of the class saw it. So it requires being exposed to it, and that is how the class, both of subclass A and subclass B, are drawn to ensure. And there are more criteria than that. They have to.
And you have a bunch of people in the class who have not, by definition, not been injured by the conduct that you claim is fraudulent.
So, Your Honor, this class is actually already determined. It's 1,063 members. This is not a case. Of a broad consumer product where we can't identify the class members. They've been identified actually from StemGenics's own records of who purchased this treatment. And so, this product. And so,
how are you going to figure out which of that group of people actually landed, let's say, on the website?
So those are determinations that they've been through in the district court, the qualifying process already, to ensure that every single one of those, and there were some people that were excluded from the class because they either didn't pay the purchase price or they couldn't meet those criteria of having been exposed to the satisfaction ratings on the homepage or in receiving an email. And so
okay, that's what I'm saying. So shouldn't they be excluded if they were landed on the website or they got the email, but they never saw they never actually read the satisfaction survey results?
So Your Honor, I believe that is how the class was drawn. I'd be happy to supplementally brief that. That happened post the appeal, and so it happened post the certification order. And so we'd certainly be happy to file either a supplemental brief or even a short 28-J letter to address that subsequent certification or the qualification process of the class members, the 1,063. It's about 500, 563 in subclass A and about 500 in subclass B. And I'd be happy to address that point in supplemental briefing because it's not.
What proportion of that is of the 1,000? What proportion of that that purchasers during the period in question?
So I don't have the answer to that, Your Honor, and it's not in the record before you. But it has been subsequently determined in the district court, and like I said, I'd be happy to supplementally brief that. What we did provide at the time of filing here was the most recent updated information we had about the class numbers, but it continued, there was an additional notice period, so I'd be happy to brief that if the court would allow me to do that.
Well, counsel, do you have you are over time, but we're going to wrap up so quickly. Do you have other authority other than the tobacco case for the proposition that your class members don't have to have seen the ad and it was enough for them to have been exposed to the page?
Yes, Your Honor. I have that here. Let me just pull that up. So in the Downey versus Public Storage case, the proposed class was defined. So this is on page 54.
You really are way over your time. It's Downey and what else? Just give me the sites if you would.
Page 54 of our brief, and it's 44 Catlap 5th, 1103. It's at pages 1117 and 1118. That the class was defined to include any customer who obtained the introductory rate on the storage of the defendant. So, and I'd also, again, I'd ask for permission to provide that. If I don't have that exact site in front of me, I'd also ask for permission to do that if I can't put my finger on it, because I know that my time has
expired. You've answered my question. Thank you. If we need any other authorities, we'll issue an order requesting them. But I interrupted you mid-sentence. Do you want to wrap up your argument? Is there anything else we need to know?
Yes. I'm just concerned that I may have pulled the wrong site for you, Your Honor. So I would if you'd let me file at least a quick letter. But what we would ask here for the result, my closing thought, is that we would request the court affirm the certification order and permit the case to proceed to trial. There was no abuse of discretion here. It's not been shown that there was any clear error of finding a fact, nor a legal error or an abuse of discretion in weighing the factors. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both. Well argued.
Counsel, did either one of you intend to submit rebuttal?
Your Honor, we had asked for a rebuttal, 2 minutes, I believe.
And you're both way over time, so I'll give you a minute if you want to. I'm not sure which of you is going to argue, but...
Thank you, Your Honor. Just briefly, I think that with regard to the concern that the court has articulated, I think the district court did make it clear that its intent was to try and certify those who had saw the misrepresentations, because if it's not those that saw the misrepresentations, then this whole thing falls apart. There's no materiality, there's no reliance, there's none of those issues. However, the definition that was ultimately agreed upon by the court is inconsistent with that. And there are a number of internal inconsistencies with the court's order, as we've identified in our briefing. The two things that I would like to just emphasize for the court is that we have, the only thing we have is materiality as to consideration. We do not have a link which takes materiality from consideration to the purchase here. We also don't have a damages theory that ties...
I don't understand. I'm sorry, I just don't understand what you just said. You don't have a link that takes materiality to the purchasing decision. What does that mean?
Your Honor, the court's order made it clear that it was excluding Dr. Kamen's report for purposes of establishing causation. So this gets back to the class-wide mechanism and whether or not this is the appropriate method for trying this case. And I would submit we don't have that link and we don't have a damages model, this case should not be certified.
I understand. Thank you very much for clarifying that.
Thank you, counsel. Thank all counsel for your argument. They're very helpful. We'll go ahead and take that case under advisement and move on to the last case on the calendar today, please.